I read Merlstein, Parshas Mishpatim, February 4th, 2015.
Okay, so first of all, thank you, Dr. Ari. His name is not Irene, if anyone can catch that mistake. That was last week's problem.
There you go.
I don't know if you caught the most recent mistake. In the Tuesday midweek brief, it said it was at 8 o'clock. But, all right, but Bashert, I want to thank everybody for coming. We're back. And I think this is your second time.
This is my fourth time.
Fourth time.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I think so. Yeah.
Speaker always remembers. unfortunately, I have to be somewhere, but without any further ado, Dr. Ari Merlstein.
Thank you, Howie. Okay, so I want to talk about the comparison between the laws of the goring ox in this week's Parsha and the laws of goring ox that we have in a couple of other ancient Near Eastern law codes. So I want to actually start with the Mor Nevuchim, because what the Rambam is going to do is hopefully the Rambam will frame what I'm trying to accomplish in general, which is to place these biblical texts within their larger historical context. What the Rambam is going to say is that if we had knowledge, we had more knowledge, Rambam, again, is writing before the advent of modern archaeology, if we had more knowledge of what ancient Near Eastern culture was like, we would know so much more about the Chukim in the Torah. I mean, there's so many laws whose reason we don't know, the Rambam says, because we just don't know enough about the wider society in which Bnei Israel lived. So now that we have all of the resources from archaeology, the point is that we can make good on the Rambam's program and try to understand better what we have in Tanakh by placing Tanakh in a wider historical context. So let's start by looking at the Rambam. Okay, well, I'll read in the English. You can follow along in the Hebrew. Most of the statutes, the chukim, the reason of which is unknown to us, serve as a fence against idolatry. Meaning that's the Rambam posits that that's the reason behind the chukim. We just don't know exactly how that works. That I cannot explain some details of the above laws or show their use is owing to the fact that what we hear from others is not so clear as that which we see with our own eyes. Thus, my knowledge of the Sabian doctrines, apparently this is an idolatrous group that with which the Rambam was familiar, my knowledge of the Sabian doctrines which I derived from books is not as complete as the knowledge of those who have witnessed the public practice of those idolatrous customs, especially as they have been out of practice and entirely extinct since 2,000 years. If we knew all the particulars of the Sabian worship and were informed of all the details of those doctrines, we would clearly see the reason and wisdom of every detail in the sacrificial service, in the laws concerning things that are unclean, and in other laws, the object of which I am unable to state. I have no doubt that all these laws serve to blot out wrong principles from man's heart and to exterminate the practices which are useless. Meaning, if I knew more about Avodah Zarah, the Rambam says, I would be able to explain all of the nuances in the laws of Korbanot and in the laws of Toman Tahara. So the Rambam wasn't able to do that. What I'd like to do tonight is to just try and take that approach in order to explain some of the very interesting aspects of the laws of goring ox in this week's Parsha. Okay, so let's actually start with with this week's Parsha, the laws of the goring ox. So turn to page 2. We'll come back to the stuff on page 1 in a little bit once we've had a chance to explore what we have in this week's Parsha. Okay, so here I'm going to read the Hebrew. You can follow along in the English. And we'll come back to why certain passages are bolded a little later. So here we have a non-habitual gorer, a shore that has not gored before. In this case, if the shore gores a person to death, the shore is stoned, its flesh isn't eaten, but the owner of the shore is not punished. If you have a habitual gorer where the owner of the shore did not do an adequate job of guarding it, the shore again is stoned, and in this instance, the owner of the shore is also killed. In that latter case, the habitual gorer, if kofar is imposed upon the owner of the shore, v'natan pidyon nafsho, then he can give pidyon nafsho, a redemption for his life, k'chol asher yushat alav, in accordance with whatever amount is imposed upon him. Ovein yigach, ovad yigach, kamishpat hazeh yeyaseh lo. Same law for a for a son or a daughter. Im eved yigach hashor o ama kesef shloshim shkalim yitain la'adonav yashor yisakel. If the victim is an eved, so in that case there is a set monetary penalty. The set monetary penalty is shloshim shkalim, but even in that case the shor is killed. Okay, then the Torah goes through the laws of what happens if someone falls into a boar, and then it comes back to the laws about a goring ox in Pasuk Lamed Hay. But here it's not what happens when an ox gores an ox, when an ox gores a person. Pasuk Lamed Hay and Lamed Vav, it's what happens when an ox gores another ox. So it's unusual. What we have is we have two different sets of laws about goring oxen. One about an ox that gores a person, the other about an ox that gores another person's ox, but those separate sets of laws are broken up by this intervening passage about the law of boar. Okay, just something to observe that we'll come back to. Okay, that's the passage about the goring oxen that we have in the Torah. In addition, we have other law codes from the Near East that have laws of the goring ox, and we're going to be looking at two of them. One of them is called the laws of Eshnuna. The other is the well-known laws of Hammurabi. So just turn to the back page for a second. The last page is a map, just so that we have our bearings as to where these places are. So laws of Eshnuna come from a place called Eshnuna. You see where it says Zagros? Kind of like on the right-hand side, you see the Caspian Sea. If you look to the south, you see it says Zagros. If you look west of where it says Zagros, you see the word Eshnuna. Okay, that's where the empire of Eshnuna was based. So we're talking about kind of southern Mesopotamia. Okay, you see the Tigris and Euphrates are the two bodies of water, so we're talking about the Fertile Crescent here. Eshnuna basically is along the Tigris. Babylon, which is where Code of Hammurabi is coming from, is just to the south of that. Okay, so Code of Hammurabi is coming from a slightly later date, mid-18th century. Eshnun is probably 19th century, but basically we're talking about contemporaneous texts from around the same region. Okay? 19th, yeah, Eshnun is around 19th century. Hammurabi is like 18th century, BCE, of course, right? Okay, so laws of Eshnuna cover the same cases as Mishpatim. So let's start with Eshnuna. If an ox has gored another ox and caused its death, the owners of the oxen shall divide between them the sale value of the living ox and the carcass of the dead ox. So that's a case of a shor goring another shor. In that case, the owners split the losses. That's going to be the same, that halacha is the same halacha that the Torah has. Where the Torah deviates is in the next set of laws. So Eshnuna, in law number 54, if an ox was a habitual gorer, the local authorities having so duly notified its owner, yet he did not keep his ox in check and it then gored a man and caused his death, the owner of the ox shall pay 2/3 of a mina of silver. So here we have the case of the habitual gorer. Remember, in the case of the Torah, we said that the law of the habitual gorer, when a shor gores another person to death and has habitually done so, the law is twofold. First of all, the shor is stoned and the owner is killed, with the option that we will impose kofar, this ransom, instead of killing the owner. So the difference between the Torah and laws of Eshnuna on this count are twofold. First of all, nothing happens to the ox. Okay, the ox isn't killed. The ox is considered completely innocent of any wrongdoing. That's number one. Number two, the penalty that we impose on the owner of the ox is not death, but it's simply a monetary penalty. Okay, it's 2/3 of a mina of silver. That's 40 shkalim. Okay, so that's what we have in the case of laws of Eshnuna in the case of a habitual gorer. Now we have, let's go to Hammurabi. Turn the page for a second. So the top law in the Code of Hammurabi, law 251. But if someone's ox was a habitual gorer, the local authority having notified him that it was a habitual gorer, yet he did not have its horn screened nor kept his ox under control, and that ox then gored a freeborn man to death, he must pay 1/2 mina of silver. So how does the case in Hammurabi compare to Eshnuna? How do they resemble each other? Same exact case, habitual gorer. How exactly do they resemble each other? Is Hammurabi closer to the law in the Torah or closer to the law in Eshnunah? Eshnunah, right? Basically, it's the same law as in Eshnunah. Habitual gorer, nothing happens to the ox. We impose a penalty on the owner, financial in nature. The difference between Eshnunah and Hammurabi is relatively minor, namely that according to Hammurabi, the penalty that we impose on the owner is a half minah, which is 30 shkalim, whereas according to Eshnunah, the penalty is 40 shkalim. Now, Eshnunah doesn't have the case of the non-habitual gorer. That case does appear in Hammurabi. Okay, so turn back for a moment, previous page. Law 250 in Hammurabi is the case of the non-habitual gorer. If an ox, while walking in the street, gored a person and caused his death, no claims will be allowed in that case. So the idea is, why is it an ox while walking in the street? Meaning we have no reason to suspect that this ox would ever cause damage. It's just walking in the street in the course of, you know, whatever it is that oxen do in the street. This ox comes across a person, gores the person to death. In that case, there's no penalty. So in some ways there, the difference between what we have in Mishpatim and what we have in Hammurabi is equally striking, because in Mishpatim, in the case of a non-habitual gorer, we actually don't only kill the ox, but we stone the ox to death. In the case of Hammurabi, there's absolutely no culpability. So what we see in both cases, the case of the non-habitual gorer, where the owner is not punished, but we stone the ox to death, and the case of the habitual gorer, where we again stone the ox to death, but now also give the either submit the owner to capital punishment or else impose on him this ransom, as opposed to Eshnunah Hammurabi, where in the case of the non-habitual gorer, there's nothing. In the case of the habitual gorer, it's simply a financial penalty. So the question is how exactly we make sense of the differences between these different law codes. So one thing that we need to observe, if you have to sort of think about what exactly is the fundamental difference between these various texts, between Mishpatim on the one hand and the ancient Near Eastern codes on the other hand. The basic difference is how we evaluate human life. Okay? What does that mean? It means that according to the ancient Near Eastern codes, according to Hammurabi, according to Eshnunah, we can evaluate a person's life in dollars and cents. So there's no instance in this case where we're going to impose any form of capital punishment even though a human life has been taken. And the same thing is true in the case of both Hammurabi and Eshnunah. The opposite is true as well. We'll often treat property actually or offenses against property will often be treated with greater weight, with greater severity than offenses against people. So that, for instance, in the case of Hammurabi, theft, meaning standard burglary, will be punished as a capital offense in Hammurabi. So we have this irony. You have theft and burglary that are treated as a capital offense, but when you have a case of homicide, negligent homicide in this case, there's absolutely no penalty in the case of the unintentional homicide. So life is treated in many ways like a commodity in the ancient Near Eastern codes, whereas what we're seeing in the case of Mishpatim is life is never being treated as a commodity. Meaning in none of the cases in the Torah are we treating the death of the person as a financial penalty in principle. Right? It's always going to be something that is capital in nature.
Except for the Eved.
Right. So the Eved, so we're going to have to come back to the case of the Eved in a few minutes. But in the case of a person goring a freeborn person to death, it's always going to be treated as capital offense. Yeah.
There's also an Eved.
Okay, right. Correct. Right. The other thing. Exactly. Right. The other thing is going to be the fact that you're not going to be able to eat the flesh of the animal, which is something.
Assuming that you took the other hanah of like selling his leather or something.
Right. So from the Torah, it sounds like lo ye'achel et b'saro. Right, of nature of the ox, because that's not that, right. We're going to come back to the fact that you're not eating the flesh of it a little bit later. Yeah, it tells us something about the nature of the offense that's been committed by the ox. Right. Now, it's been suggested that the basic difference, why is it that human life is being evaluated at a higher level in the case of the Torah, has to do with the notion in the Torah, and this is where the Torah is unique, the idea that man is created B'Tselem Elohim. So take a look at the last page. So this is going back to Parshat Noach. We'll look at the earlier psukim in this parsha in a little bit, but Pasuk Hey, V'ach et dimchem lenafshotechem edrosh, miyad kol chaya edreshenu, u'miyad ha'adam, miyad ish achiv, edrosh et nefesh ha'adam. Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech, ki b'tzelem Elohim asat ha'adam. The person who kills another person, the English translation is a little bit stunted here, but whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. The idea is, if you look at the structure of that pasuk, shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech, you have a perfect chiastic structure, because the idea is this is mida keneged mida. If you kill someone, you snuff out another tzelem Elohim, the immediate response is going to be, we are going to deprive you of your tzelem Elohim. Meaning, why is it that the Torah doesn't treat humans as property? Torah isn't treating humans as property because there's a fundamental difference, in this case, between people and things. The fundamental difference between people and things, according to the Torah, is that people are endowed with a tzelem Elohim, something that we don't find in the case of things. That's not true when it comes to the Mesopotamian context. In the Mesopotamian context, the place of a person in the cosmos is imagined entirely differently. And that's because the basic difference between polytheism and monotheism is in their notion of God. In a polytheistic system, no God is all-powerful. All of the gods, by definition, are limited in their capacity. And so even the chief gods, so let's take the gods in the Canaanite pantheon, right? The gods who were in the vicinity of Bnei Israel. So the chief god was Baal, the rain god, the storm god. But the stories that the Canaanites tell about Baal demonstrate with certainty that this chief god in their pantheon was very restricted in the scope of his ability. So he's not crowned as the chief god according to Canaanite mythology until he overcomes Yam, the sea god. But there's this cosmic clash that takes place between Yam, the sea god, and Baal, the storm god. Then Baal is crowned as king, chief god. Right, his father is El, but now Baal is the rain god. Of course, rain, storm is going to be a major commodity in that area, and so it's not a coincidence that Baal, the rain god, is the chief god. But Baal, before he can be coronated, has to go to his brother Mot, god of death, and inform Mot that he's going to be coronated. Meaning, before Baal can become king, he needs to overcome his two arch nemeses, both his brothers, Yam and Mot. And according to the Canaanite myth, Mot actually defeats Baal, and Baal is actually swallowed up by Mot, and Baal isn't actually saved. Baal hangs out in the underworld until his consort, Astarte, Ashtoreth, comes and saves him. But Baal by himself was secondary in some ways in terms of his power to Mot, needed the assistance of one of the other goddesses to save him. So you see very clearly the way in which this chief god is not by himself all-powerful. Within a system where none of the gods are all-powerful, what that means is that basically the gods are like superhuman. None of them are really kind of like, can be imagined as existing on an entirely separate plane. All of them have human needs. All of them need to eat. They engage in sexual relations. All of them need to be clothed. Right? The basic human needs are things that are true of the gods as well. The difference between God and man, in this case, is that the gods are immortal. But basically, in terms of their daily needs, they're completely subject to the same problems that humans are. And so, for instance, again, the mythology that I was talking about before. How did the Canaanites understand the cycles of the seasons? How did they imagine how it went from fall to winter to spring to summer? They imagined that each year Baal was dying and needed to be revived, and that explains the flow of the seasons. Meaning, how did they conceive of why it was that sometimes you had a rainy season and then other times, you know, the sun came out? Well, precisely because you had the cycle of Baal intermittently dying and then being revived. Within a system like that, people play an essential role, but it's a very different role than the one that they play in a monotheistic system. In a polytheistic system where the gods have needs, people are there to serve the needs of the gods. So sacrifices within a polytheistic system are there to serve the needs of the need to sustain the gods. Gods have to eat. Gods have to be clothed. Magic is a way of compelling the gods to do, to submit to your will. How do you control the gods? That's precisely what magic is. How do you get the gods to pay attention to you? But there are various methods that people have in order to do that. The gods, according to, again, these mythologies, created man not because they felt like there was something important about mankind, but actually because they needed someone to relieve them of their duties. Because until man was created, the gods were the only ones who were there to do work. And it became really laborious for the gods to have to sustain themselves. And so they created humanity simply in order to work the land, because otherwise they were the ones who were stuck having to do that. So man is not going to occupy such a lofty plateau in a polytheistic system where his sole function is to serve the needs of the gods, where the gods themselves essentially are kind of superhuman. That's going to be different than in the monotheistic system, because in the monotheistic system, we're talking about a god who is removed from the world. Why is it that God creates man, B'Tselem Elohim? Because the idea is, when you have a god who is all-powerful, so God doesn't actually need man to sustain him, but what is God doing with man? God is endowing man in some way with a piece of himself. He is delegating to man the role of a mini-god on earth. It's in that way that man is representing God on earth. And so man, in that case, plays a completely different role within the cosmos than he does in a polytheistic system. So man is not going to be understood in the same terms in a polytheistic and a monotheistic system. Yeah? So the gods are going to be created in a polytheistic system. So different myths talk about how it is that they came about. In some cases, there's this like undifferentiated mass that's there, almost like what we have in the Torah, where you have the Tahom that's there, whatever is there at the beginning. But in the Torah, there's a god that somehow pre-exists. In some of the myths, it's almost like spontaneous combustion, and sort of the gods come into being. In other of the myths, there are two gods who are there at the beginning, and one of them slays the other and creates the world out of the flesh of the one that's been slain, and the gods are then what are created next. But in any case, the gods are like people in that they also don't pre-exist. So there too, basically what you have is you have humanity playing the role in the polytheistic system. Gods are basically just superhumans, where the main difference is just that the gods are immortal, and at least in one domain, each of the gods is all powerful. Okay, so why is it then? How does this explain why it is that the punishment in the case of the Torah is so harsh? It's precisely because when you have an ox goring a person to death, what we have is we have a complete reversal of the created order. We have an ox who is supposed to be, within a monotheistic system, is supposed to be subordinate to man, is supposed to be below the one who has Tzelem Elohim, is now the one who is actually snuffing out the one who has the Tzelem Elohim. Understood a little bit differently, we can almost analogize the case of a shore goring a person to death as the case of Avodah Zarah, meaning in what way can this be understood along the lines of idolatry? Think about the other cases that are subject to stoning. So cases that are subject to skila in the Torah are relatively few. Typically, it's going to be cases where the offense goes to the very heart, and really violates the fabric of the community. So we have Avodah Zarah, we have sorcery, we have Ben Sora Ramora. We have Avodah Zarah. We have violating Shabbos. We have child sacrifice. Those are some of the paradigmatic cases that are subject to Skila. Those are the cases where Sefer Dvarim says, why are you supposed to do this? V'chol ha'am yishma'u v'yira'u. The idea is this is a public spectacle. Stoning isn't simply meted out by one person, chopping off a person's head. This is supposed to be a communal effort that represents the community trying to expel the sinner from their midst. The case of the Ir HaNidachat is a good example of this, because the case of the Ir HaNidachat, what's the punishment for the Ir HaNidachat? So the case of the Ir HaNidachat is similar to what we do with the shore, in the sense that we don't actually touch any part of the Ir HaNidachat at all. It's all supposed to stay cherem. The property that belongs to the Ir HaNidachat is supposed to stay completely off limits. Meaning, in some way, what you have in the case of Avodah Zarah, in the case of the Ir HaNidachat, is you have man subverting God's authority in a way that what you have here is you have an animal subverting man's authority. Here you have man representing the Tzelem Elohim being undone by someone who is lower down in the cosmic hierarchy. And so in the same way that we treat the Ir HaNidachat basically as completely off limits, this is like, you know, a freak act of nature. And so we demonstrate that by basically leaving it off to the side. The same thing is what's happening in the case of the shore. And so we're not going to touch the flesh of the shore. We're not going to eat it, because it's something analogous to the case of the Ir HaNidachat. Now, why is it that the shore is being killed? It's not that we're treating the shore as a murderer. What's the penalty that is imposed on the standard case of a murder? When a person kills another person, what's the punishment according to the Torah? So it's not skila. It's the beginning of this week's parsha. Makei ish vameit mot yumat. So it's simply, right, and so generally, when the Torah says mot yumat, we assume that the punishment there is hereg, right? Killing by sword. That's the standard case of murder. And you see, just in this case, you can see that the case of skila somehow is, we have to pay attention to the fact that the penalty being imposed on the shore is skila, because there's a difference even in this case between the penalty that's being imposed on the shore and the penalty that's being imposed on the shore's owner. In the case of the habitual gorer, hashor yisakel, v'gam ba'alav yumat. We're not stoning the owner of the ox to death. The owner is being treated as he would be in any other standard case of homicide. But the shore is the one that's being singled out in some way. And the shore is the one that's being singled out, not because we're treating the shore as a murderer, but because this entire scenario represents kind of something that goes to the heart of this community's values, to the integrity of the community, which is based on this cosmic hierarchy of God, man, and animal. And when you have an undermining, when you have some kind of a subverting of that order, the ramifications are far-reaching. So that would be one suggestion for why it is that what we have here is the shore being stoned to death in every case, not because we regard the shore as culpable, but because whatever has happened here is in some way a subversion of the natural order, and therefore we're going to punish the shore, even if it just happened to be walking in the street, even in the case of the non-habitual gore. Yeah?
By contrast, there's this idea that non-kosher animals are carnivorous animals. In other words, they eat their prey. Here you have a case of the shore, which is not carnivorous, but winds up killing the person. Is it possible that there's a relationship between both kosher and carnivorous loving and health?
Where the idea is we want to treat...
Yeah. We can't, not just talking about, but I'm not talking so much about the skill, I'm talking about the loyach.
Right.
As well, it's not chef, you could eat him anyway.
Right, well, so that's what's interesting, that the loyach helps. Sorry, that, yeah, but go ahead.
But it sounds a little bit like conscious, you have this whole idea that carnivorous animals are treif, and one who allows to eat a gentleman ones, they're not carnivorous.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have a shore that in theory is not carnivorous, but it's just killed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps there's a relationship between this murder of shore and
that's interesting. Right, that's interesting.
That are carnivorous.
Right, interesting. I'd never thought about that. That's interesting. Yeah, interesting. Thank you. Interesting. The other thing that we need to pay attention to in this regard is the place of kofar in all of this. Because what I said before is that we're not treating this simply as a financial penalty, because we treat cases of the Torah treat people and things completely differently. The case of kofar is exceptional in this regard. There's the possibility that we're going to impose a financial penalty on the owner of the habitual gorer, which is exceptional in the Torah, because in general in the Torah we never accept kofar in cases of homicide. That's the bottom pasuk that you have on page 2. So this is from the end of Bamidbar. Komake nefesh l'fi edim yirtzach et harotzeach v'ed echad lo ya'anev nefesh lamut v'lo tikhu kofar l'nefesh rotzeach asher hu rasha lamut kimot yumat. And then, I don't know if I have this here, but v'lo tachanifu et ha'aretz. The idea is if you take kofar, if you don't simply murder, if you don't simply punish the murderer in kind, that's going to contaminate the land. And so you can never take kofar. And yet in this case, we're taking kofar. It's the Torah's admission that this is not quite the paradigmatic case of homicide, meaning it recognizes that there's something different about this case. And so that even while in principle the owner of the habitual gorer can be killed, we also allow for the possibility that the family of the deceased will opt for kofar instead of insisting on the death of the murderer. So there is an awareness that this is not the exact same case, but the Torah's, the idea here is that in principle, this is a case of homicide. Now, even in imposing kofar, that's not a financial penalty. How do you know it's not a financial penalty? First of all, it doesn't specify how much it is, exactly. And how else do you know from here that it's not a financial penalty? Has it referred to kofar? Pidyon nafsho. So if pidyon nafsho here refers to the nefesh of the killer, the murderer, so here the idea is this kofar takes the place of, this is in place of his nefesh, meaning in principle, he should be giving up his life, but instead we're almost transferring his life to this money. This is not simply a financial penalty. This is a way out in an exceptional instance where we recognize that this is not kind of paradigmatic homicide. So, what's that? Yeah, exactly. Well, kofar, the idea of kofar, it's from the same shorish as kapara. What is kapara? Kapara is basically covering up sin. That's what, when we're v'chiper, you know, v'chiper ha-kohen in the mikdash, that's exactly what is happening on Yom Kippur. We're essentially covering up the tumah. It's a process of covering up and transferring. And that's exactly what's happening here. We're sort of covering up the sin and transferring the, you know, what should be a penalty on the person over to the money, which is then being transferred to the family of the deceased.
Is it covering up or substitution?
Kofar literally means to cover up, but it's a substitution in that way. Yeah. Now, the case of the Eved is interesting because the case of the Eved is this in-between case. On the one hand, you have that's the one case where you have a financial penalty being imposed. You have shloshim shkalim, but you there too though you have the shor yisakel. So that case is on the one hand admitting that the eved, like anyone else, is endowed with the tzelem Elohim, and so hashor yisakel as in every other case. But it also allows for the fact that the Eved has actual concrete financial value. Meaning there is a way in which an Eved is also has property value in practice. And so it doesn't necessarily defy everything else that the Torah is doing here by imposing a concrete financial penalty in the case of the goring of the Eved. What's remarkable there is not so much that it imposes a discrete financial penalty as that it recognizes that the Eved shares this fundamental similarity with everyone else, namely the fact that that the Eved as well is endowed with the Tzelem Elohim. So that would seem to be what's taking place in the case of the Eved. Now, one additional thing that becomes interesting in this regard is the difference between the shor goring a person to death and the shor goring another ox to death. Because as dramatic as the difference is between Mishpatim and the other law codes when it comes to a shor goring a person to death, the law is actually identical when it comes to a shor goring another ox to death. So this is Lamed Hei and Lamed Vav on page 2. V'chi yigov shor ish et shor re'ehu v'meit, u'machru et ashor hachai v'chatzu et kaspo, v'gam et hameit yechatzun. The exact same penalty as we saw in Eshnuna, namely when you have an ox scoring another ox to death, it's treated as a standard standard civil offense, and therefore the punishment that's imposed is identical in each case. Namely, we're not going to simply let the losses lie where they may. We're actually going to set up an equitable situation where each one of them shares in the losses. Now, why is it that all of a sudden the Torah comes out on the same side as the other law codes in this case? It's precisely because of this difference. Namely, there's a fundamental difference between humans and property, and so it's not a coincidence that in the cases of property, the law is going to be the same. But the Torah flags the fact that the two cases are different, that the case of an ox goring an ox is different from the case of an ox goring a person by separating them with the case of boar. Meaning, what would happen if you juxtaposed them? All of the cases of a goring ox were all put together. You would have the impression somehow that there's just a continuum. You know, there's one case of an ox goring an ox, and then you have the more severe case of an ox goring a person. But by separating them out, by clearly demarcating the difference, by putting the case of the boar in between, what it's saying is that the two cases of a shore goring share nothing in common. The shore goring a person to death can't be imagined in property terms on any level. And therefore, since it shares nothing in common, the Torah doesn't even want to put them together. And therefore, it separates them with the case of boar, which is obviously, unambiguously, a case of a property offense. So the Torah seems to be signaling for us exactly how it is that those two cases share this... how the two cases are fundamentally different. Yeah.
Is there a connection by the lack of responsibility of the owner?
In other words, by
the boar following it, it's pointing out that the first case of the shore might be about the owner not taking responsibility of.
In the case of a shore goring a person or shore goring.
Shore goring a person.
So in the case of the non habitual gore, so nothing happens to the owner. Yeah.
Or that the human owner is not taking the responsibility, it needs to do the same as a boar as in the boar.
Right. So meaning, why is it?
It seems like the onus is more on the owner.
Well, in the case of the boar, the it's not a person that's being. So that's a total property offense. So the only penalty that we're going to impose on him is financial in nature. So now one last observation to make about all of this. You would get the impression, based on these various codes, that cases of goring oxen were especially common. Because after all, what do we have? We have three different law codes, and in all of them we have cases of goring oxen. Now, what therefore is very interesting is the fact that in the tens of thousands of court documents that we have from the ancient Near East, virtually none of them deal with cases of goring oxen. Which means that this wasn't an especially common case. For whatever reason it made it into the ancient Near Eastern codes, why does it make it into Mishpatim, if this is the case? If in fact this wasn't really a practical case, it wasn't going to be that you're going to have lots of cases of goring oxen appearing before judges, why does it make its way into Mishpatim? Because the point here is, this is immediately after Matan Torah, to a generation that is just now experiencing what it means to be subject to one God, they have to have explained to them the way in which monotheism is fundamentally different from polytheism. And so what does the Torah do? The Torah is Dibraha Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam. The people are familiar with these ancient Near Eastern codes. They understand what the law is in these codes. And so how does the Torah signal what is different about monotheism from polytheism? By recycling the very same laws that are in these other codes, but signaling how the Torah is different by changing the law in these very fundamental ways. Meaning, for a culture that would have been familiar with a code like Hammurabi and knew that in the case of a shore goring another person, basically the penalty is financial. And now you have a generation leaving the Midbar, leaving Mitzrayim, comes into the Midbar, has just received the Torah, and hears that in the case of a shore goring a person, Hashor Yisakel V'gam Be'alav Yumat. Why is that? How are they going to, what insight is that going to provide for them? They will, in a very concrete way, acquire the understanding that the Torah is valuing a person's life differently from the system that they've grown up with. That will be a very concrete way for these Jews who are just now shifting from polytheism to monotheism to really internalize what the difference is between their new system and the old system. So even in the case of the Torah, it's not that this was necessarily going to be a case that was going to come up constantly. But the laws in the Torah were also meant to serve an important ideological purpose. In this case, the ideological purpose was to instruct Bnei Israel about the difference between polytheism and monotheism, essentially by building upon the foundations of the law codes that already existed. So to go back to the Rambam, how is it that we can better appreciate Parshat Mishpatim and the laws that we have there in light of the other law codes? We can understand why it is that the Torah is formulating the laws of the goring oxen in the way that they do. It's not simply a reflection of the Torah's ideology, but it's also a mode of instruction, a way of teaching the people who are now shifting from polytheism to monotheism what is different about the monotheistic system from the polytheistic system. And it's by subtly shifting those critical details that that Bnei Israel are now able to acquire this new understanding, just as they're acquiring their new identity. Thank you very much. Did I... Okay.